people take information and need information in different ways, and dealing with dealing with conflict. You know, often, especially in a hospital environment, a lot of that conflict and anxiety is driven out of fear. You know, and knowing that allows you then to take a different stance if you know that you're dealing with somebody's fear rather than somebody's anger.
That was Mark Hannaford, and this is the All Things Risk podcast. Welcome and welcome back to another episode of the All Things Risk podcast. My name is Ben Cattaneo. I'm your host. This is my show. And if you're a regular listener, you know that this is where we get to go deep and long form using the lenses of risk and uncertainty with some fascinating guests to cover a range of very, very interesting topics. No matter where you are, however you're listening to this, I hope that you are all well. And I wanted to also thank you for being here and joining me on this podcast journey. It's an honor to share all of these episodes with you. The episode that I'm about to bring you is a conversation about extremes. And as a risk person, extremes fascinate me because that's where we come face to face with uncertainty. And we learn at the extremes, we discover at the extremes, and my guest, Mark Hannaford, is all about that. He's an entrepreneur, he's a veteran of many expeditions into so-called extreme environments, deserts, mountains, jungles, all over the world. He is the founder of something called World Extreme Medicine and the World Extreme Medicine Conference, which is taking place in a few weeks' time in Edinburgh, Scotland. He's also the founder of an organization called Across the Divide, which is involved in leading and supporting adventures and expeditions around the world, including the popular US show Survivor, the Survivor series. Along the way, Mark has identified an acute need, and that is how can he and his organizations provide medical support in these types of environments so that the expeditions that he supports, whether they involve scientific research or humanitarian aid or otherwise, can be successful. But this is a conversation that's about a lot more than this. And I think it's human nature to explore and to learn at the edges of what's possible. And Mark, in fact, has been involved in co-founding conferences that support this and in bringing practitioners together to share insights. And we get into all of that. We talk about how Mark got into this line of work. We talk about medical support in extreme conditions, the medical profession, motivations of people who put their lives on the line to help others in these types of environments, decision-making and mental strength in extreme environments. And we get into extreme medicine in many types of environments, including space, the final frontier. This is a wonderful conversation. It's quite fascinating. I enjoyed having Mark on the show, and I think you'll enjoy this as well. Ladies and gentlemen, here's Mark Hannaford. So, Mark, welcome to the All Things Risk podcast. It's a pleasure to have you here in person, and I think we're going to have a wonderful conversation.
Thank you, Ben. Lovely to be here. Thank you for inviting me.
So, I want to get into extreme medicine. But before we do that, I want to maybe explore your backstory, your origin story, because working in extreme medicine is probably not something you thought you would be doing when you were growing up and studying. You were studying geography and geology, I believe. So just tell us a little bit about what your background was growing up, what you enjoyed doing, what you wanted or thought you might be doing.
Well, I guess when I grew up, my academic background, my degree is in geography and geomorphology. Mm-hmm. So that was my interest. So, you know, I'm non-clinician. So, and I've arrived at, in a way, I suppose I've arrived at extreme medicine, but when I was growing up, extreme medicine as a concept really didn't exist. Mm-hmm. In fact, if anything, through the kind of work we've been doing over the last 15 to 20 years, you know, it's become a medical subdiscipline. Mm-hmm. And we've combined elements of different remote medicine, pre-hospital mm-hmm. care type streams into into extreme medicine to provide best practice. So, you know, as a non-clinician, I certainly didn't expect to be working so heavily, and in a way created almost a medical subdiscipline. Mm-hmm. It's an unusual place to be, and I don't know whether that's reasonably actually unique. Typically, of course, medical subdisciplines are created by clinicians and researchers else. So it's fascinating place to be. But I think my driver for how I've arrived where I am is essentially based on a love of the outdoors and a desire for adventure and travel.
Right. Did you travel a lot as a child?
Yeah,
and you spend a lot of time outdoors?
To a degree. My father was a captaincy, so we moved to the Caribbean when I was young and lived in Antigua for a couple of years, and then moved with him to the Middle East where I went to school in the UK. Mm-hmm. And then travelled out to the Middle East. But, you know, aside from that, I always had a strong urge to travel. So, you know, when I was younger, I had a stamp collection with foreign stamps, which, you know, I identified with the with the names and the places on those stamps.
Sure.
And, you know, in a childish way, that's where my sort of original sort of hit list for places I wanted to go came from. You know, and actually with... through the travel I've done, but also the expeditions that I've been involved in, I've actually managed to tick off quite a few of those sort of childhood places that some of them no longer exist. They're different places.
Right.
But it was always in me. And I understand for lots of people that is the case. They have that wanderlust and other people don't. And it's what makes people different, which is fascinating.
Mm. So I can understand what drew you to geography. What is it that you thought you wanted to do? Or?
Well, I guess, do you know what? I actually wanted to... There were two things I wanted to do. One was, I realized later, I would have loved to have done, would have been zoology and natural sciences. And the other thing would have been social anthropology. And I got a place to do a master's at Edinburgh and UCL to do an MSc in social anthropology. But I got an expedition invitation, and I took the expedition. And
we have to talk about that then.
That was the first step in you know, how I've ended up here, really.
Mm-hmm. What was the expedition all about?
Well, funnily enough, I got invited to work for one of the expedition ship companies running boats or ribs. So the rigid inflatables that are used to transfer clients from the ship to the shore. So Zodiacs sort of with outboard motors. Mm-hmm. Working in Kamchatka, which is in the Russian Far East. Mm-hmm. So that was really a once in a lifetime opportunity and a place I'd always wanted to go to and been fascinated by. So I jumped at that opportunity, then stayed on the vessel and then traveled down through the coast of China, through Japan, down to Indonesia, and then spent several months in Indonesia working. And, you know, that sort of introduced me to the whole concept of actually working freelance and working in expeditions and working in adventure travel. And, you know, there's really where my sort of career doing this started. Mm. I'd worked in Morocco as a mountain guide previous to that, so I had
as you do.
Well, I kind of, and actually Morocco, I have to say, still remains one of my most favourite places. Mm-hmm. Just such a stunning country and a fascinating culture and lovely people. So it suited me to be waking up every day with a different view outside my window, or outside my tent, or outside my hut, wherever I was staying. It suited my personality then, and suits my personality now to a degree.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's clearly the non-conventional path. I read somewhere that you were a field geologist for a little while.
Yeah, a lot of these jobs were expeditions. By their very nature, are relatively short. They could be a couple of months, or they could be short. So there were a number of expeditions that actually followed on quite quickly, and I worked for what was then called Operation Rally, which is now Rally International, which is a large sort of youth expedition charity, which is, I have to say, absolutely gave me the foundation for the work I'm doing. Mm-hmm. I worked for them in the Northern Territories in Australia. Once that had finished, I stayed on for a year and I was literally walking down the high street in Darwin, which is the capital of the Northern Territory, with about $5 left in my pocket, thinking I have to get a job. And looking around for jobs. And at that stage, Darwin was a lot smaller than it is now. And there wasn't an awful lot around. But I just happened to bump into a friend from England walking the other way who just happened to get a job working in a geological office doing some data analysis. Mm-hmm. In fact, that's Ian, who still works for me now. We've been working together with some other colleagues for almost 30 years based on our time at Operation Rally, which is fairly remarkable, actually. There's not many people who get to work with their colleagues for that period of time. And he said, do you know, they need somebody. And I'd literally just come out of the bush, having spent a couple of months sort of driving across the Tanami Desert to the Gulf of Carpentaria, doing a project with the Museum of the Northern Territory. I think I've got that name right. Collecting animal samples, reptile samples for their DNA sampling. And so my field experience was just that. I'd literally just dusted the bag off and put it into a room. So going back out again, with a really small team. So essentially the team was a helicopter pilot, myself driving the Land Rover and the geologist. So what we would do is the helicopter would fly to where we were camped. We'd set up camp for a couple of days and take blind samples on a transect. So we were literally being flown by the helicopter. So the helicopter would drop me, then drop the geologist, then come back for me, and we'd leapfrog all day and be dropped at points on a map that were unidentifiable by any other point except for they had coordinates.
Right.
So we were literally in the middle of nowhere. Sometimes you'd have 20 minutes just standing, literally stranded in the middle of nowhere, thinking, I will have been the first person to stand in this particular spot. And it's quite a humbling experience. And also, there is a blind faith that helicopters are going to return. Actually, you're not going to be completely left. Perhaps now, if I was doing that job, I might take my sat phone with me or something like that, just for a bit of extra security. So that was a great job, actually. And I found going to the Northern Territory, because it is really the vast open spaces, I found that at the beginning quite tricky, because it was almost too blank a canvas. But then as you get into and expand your mind to being in that environment, you suddenly, actually, that blank canvas isn't blank, it's full of detail. But it takes a while to adjust to that, and actually coming out of that into a more crowded environment is also tricky as well.
I can imagine. I mean, there would be no option, I would have thought, after a few years of doing this, of any type of sort of desk job or
oddly enough, I came back from Australia and felt, I think, a little bit by peer pressure that I should conform.
We all feel that from time to time.
Yes.
Yeah.
And it was probably my most valuable experience because I actually got onto the graduate scheme for BT and worked at British Telecom for 2 or 3 years. Mm-hmm. And it was an amazing environment to work in, very supportive. The training was great. The paying conditions were great. The team I was working with were very supportive, but what it taught me was actually what I didn't like, and that was actually as important as learning what I did like. Knowing that actually that way of working didn't suit me was seminal to then saying, okay, well, that doesn't suit me. I've done that now. Tick that box. Let's go back to actually what I do really enjoy and what's good for me and what I do well, and make that work.
That's a great experience to have. I think everybody should, and probably does at some point, go through a time where they have a job where they don't particularly like, but if you, as you say, pull out the lessons around what it is you don't want to be doing, then it serves you well afterwards. So,
and I think some of the things I learnt during the graduate program, and I was there long enough to deliver some benefit back to BT, but I still use those lessons on a virtual daily basis in terms of some of the a lot of what I do is about communicating. So I learned a lot of that by... when I say communicating, in terms of, rather than telephones and what have you, but it's about sort of transmitting the passion I have for extreme medicine to people to get them on board. It's about marketing. It's about spreading the word. And, my time at BT stood me a very good stead for that.
By the way, I think we've got some graduates in the room next door who are starting, which is interesting. But communication skills or negotiation communication skills, written and verbal, all of that is great stuff that you can pick up it by doing one of these kinds of jobs. Because I think when you start in a, you know, kind of a graduate program, you know how to read, you know how to read, write, communicate. That's kind of value you can add at that point. You don't really know anything about the business or
and business practices and processes.
Sure,
and
everything else. Okay, that's that's great scene setter. I want to talk about some of where the idea of extreme medicine started to percolate, and maybe as a risk person and as a this is a risk podcast. How do you on some of these expeditions? How do you manage some of these risks that you inevitably might face? So, if the helicopter has a mechanical problem and you're stranded for a little while, you know, what tools are at your disposal?
I think there's always a degree of risk, which is what makes what we do interesting. How I arrived at extreme medicine was reasonably unique in so much as I was working as a person working as a guide, which lots of people do. But I'd also had my time at BT and had that kind of a flavour of corporate procedure, which at times is useful. And I'd also worked as a guide for what is now Lindblad National Geographic Expeditions. So an American company with high service levels, and actually that doesn't seem to marry with expeditions, but actually dealing with people is what expeditions are all about, especially if you're leading. And then I'd had some small unit training with the British Army, which had taught me standard operating procedures, the relevance of prior preparation, the relevance of standard reaction to actually certain issues and stuff, and also a robustness of reaction. So I started a company about 22 years ago called Across the Divide Expeditions, which at that time catered primarily for putting on adventurous challenges for charities. And over the last 2 decades, we've worked with virtually every major UK charity and a large number of overseas charities, and helped to facilitate raising £92 million in the process. And that company, Across the Divide, is still very much active. So it's a company that works quite a lot with the BBC. We run their Rickshaw Challenges for the One Show. It raises £4.2 million a year. We run events for Countryfile. Again, they raise £1 million a year. In the process of that, obviously, these are at times quite large numbers of people in remote areas.
So corporate people that want to do some type of a challenge and raise funds for charity, is that?
Well, typically the charity would employ us. We do CSR projects for people like National Power. Taken them to Brazil and put solar powered, built a midwife clinic in the remotest part of Amazonia, but where really they were in dire need of that service. We're working with Empower. We put in a pump and stuff and built the building. So typically the organisation approaches us, and we'll work with them provide a solution that not only provides reasonable returns for fundraising, but also may look at some of the training needs and developmental needs. We've worked with other companies taking their graduates through programmes and stuff like that.
Okay.
When we first started, primarily at the moment, our events are, there are a number overseas, but our big events with the BBC are all UK-based, with the Rickshaw Challenge. When we first started, we were doing expeditions, sometimes for as many as 100 people, to places like Kazakhstan and Namibia, Mozambique, Australia. We were literally going all over the world. They were attracting large numbers, and some of the fundraisers, everybody set a minimum target, so the charity is always guaranteed a reasonable and fair return. But a number of the fundraisers would be raising way beyond that, at times £60,000, which goes all to the charity. So some of our larger groups in themselves were raising for the charity £200,000, £250,000. It was an amazing amount of money and actually doing significant good. consequently, in order to cater for those teams, I had to put reasonably strong, robust, and big teams into the field. We'd worked previously for other companies where medical cover was provided by first aiders or medical clinicians who had non-relevant experience. So I went up Kilimanjaro, and my medical cover provided by the other company was a psychiatrist. You know, absolutely fine, but not exactly...
No, not what you need.
No, not what you need on the side of the mountain. So we decided when we set it up by us, we wanted to make sure that our medics actually were as robust as they could possibly be. We also wanted to pay them. Nobody paid medics at the time, and this still goes on now. Medics, companies will take medics onto their trip to give them medical cover. They take the medic takes on a professional liability and a responsibility, but you know, there's no recompense for the company, so it seems a slightly imbalanced and skewed relationship to me. We wanted to ensure that our doctors were paid, so they felt valued. They also knew that they were working. So if I had somebody break a leg on the side of a mountain and I needed a clinician to go with them to the hospital and potentially back to the UK, that's what they would do. There was no counter argument. But I'm on holiday. I'm not going to do that. You know, actually, the care of the casualty is paramount.
Yeah, and if you're doing these sort of corporate challenges, I mean, litigation is not in the UK what it is in the United States, for instance. But you couldn't get away with.
No, and I think it's the moral responsibility. Yes. You're being paid to take these people away. Yes. You're taking them into an environment that you're familiar with, but they're not. I think it's your moral responsibility to. You can never cling wrap and make that hermetically sealed and safe. Part of going out into these things is an element of risk, and people trip over and break their legs, but you need to have a system in place and to have thought about it carefully enough to make sure that if they do that, that you get them out as quickly as you possibly can, and in a robust manner. So we started paying doctors, and then we realized actually doctors, and again this still happens in other organizations, doctors are then expected to beg, steal and borrow off their local hospitals to provide the kit. Now, we wanted our doctors to have a kit that was unified across the board. They could turn up and know that, you know, there would be enough stuff that they needed, equipment, and it would all be provided. And initially, we employed all our mates who were doctors, and that was great, you know, because they were from an expedition background. But as we went on, as we got busier, as they got older, started having kids, you know, we needed other doctors, and typically we would gain. Recruit friends of friends, and again, typically from emergency departments. But emergency department doctors are absolutely amazing. But a lot of the stuff they do is, in terms of some of the primary care, is given over to nurses or given over, or is already done by paramedics. So when you put them into the field, you know, a lot of the stuff they know, but they haven't practiced, haven't done. And actually, we realised there was a space for a training course. So we set up a first training course, and we're quite honestly overwhelmed by the response. And so we did our first expedition medicine training course in Keswick. We realised not only was it oversubscribed, but actually what we were doing was really valuable, because we were giving clinicians who wanted to go off and do expeditions a chance to have a work-life balance, and providing, we began to see that we were setting standards, and which, as a participant in the sort of travel market, other companies were then having to to bring their own levels up to meet, because they were competing against us in the corporate market. And so we did a first UK course, and then over to, actually quite quickly, that then became two UK courses, and then a polar medicine course in Norway, and now we're presently running two polar medicine courses, one in Norway, one in New Zealand, a jungle medicine in Costa Rica, and a new desert medicine course in Oman, which actually we managed to get Prince Andrew talking about in Oman last week as he opened a new centre there, talking about the next people to turn up with are these clinicians from extreme medicine. And we've worked with National Geographic down in Antarctica, running a sort of mini shipboard conference there.
And the Survivor Series. I read about that.
So we provide the. We've got mountain medicine courses up in Abu Dhabi, Base Camp Dak in Kakua. It gives us a really strong, large pool of faculty that we use to teach on these courses, who come from working in expeditions, or we've met along the way. What it gives us, obviously, a large pool of alumni. So we were approached by CBS to provide the medical cover for their Survivor Series, which, if I'm getting my facts right, is the longest running reality TV show in the world. And they have an extremely strong core team, some of whom have been there from the beginning. But bear in mind now, and these guys have deployed into the field for 3 or 4 months, bear in mind that, you know, I think it's been going 27, 28 years. Now, 28 years ago, these guys were fit 22-year-olds.
Right, right.
They are now slightly older and carrying, illnesses and stuff, which need primary care. So they need to, you know, in terms of keeping them in the field and keeping them comfortable and keeping them safe, they need a... So essentially what we do is we build a primary care service, so a GP clinic, on-site with, co-located with them, with... which will sit there for about 4 months, staffed by about 8 medics, but also has a extremely strong trauma element. So if a crane collapses on somebody, if somebody has a near drowning, if somebody gets hit, you know, we can treat and evacuate them and get them to the next level of medical care really, really very quickly. I mean, one of the advantages with working with an organisation like Survivor, for the photography and filming, there is a helicopter on standby. So there's regular drills about stripping the camera stuff out to get casualties in. You know, and there's a large number of people, so stuff happens. But I got an amazing medical director called Dr. Joe Rolls, who runs a team there, who, you know, is also a climber himself and done expeditions and has a similar military background. So...
Sorry, go on.
Well, I think it's delivering that type of care, but also at the same time, being able to make people feel comfortable when they're coming into the surgery with their everyday ailments.
Right.
And it's, you know, sometimes you can go too far with the we're here for trauma. That's what we do. I mean, too far with the sort of primary care soft skills, and you've got to get a match in between where. It's a good balance.
And I think as someone who's not done expeditions, but is, you know, curious about it, I would want that. I'd want somebody that understands, I might have some questions. I might have, I might get an insect bite and wonder, well, is this going to kill me or not? And just need to go and see someone and get, get a little bit of,
Well, I think for what we do, the secret is to get somebody who's done so much of this stuff and knows exactly what there's no longer any need to prove themselves or arrogance. And actually, when you've done, been through that process, you understand, having done it yourself, that people who are coming to you stressed and upset often are expressing fear of the environment. So, you know, knowing that is half a battle.
Absolutely.
Because, you know, you're dealing with somebody who's not in their comfort zone. They've been taken by surprise. And actually your job is to make them feel secure and safe. And, you know, if they've got something that needs to be dealt with, deal with it as quickly as possible.
And you don't want a neophyte. You don't want somebody who's just is doing this as a...
Well-intentioned
as they might be, you want somebody that knows what they're doing and can kind of relate it to other experiences and say, oh no, you'll be fine. This is this kind of spider and it's whatever.
And these guys have all done it before, but they also there's a lot of prior preparation in terms of going out before we deploy to make sure that we've got the equipment that we need.
So this is your challenge, right? This is it's a small pool of people that do this sort of thing.
So at
a high level, and so you've gone and started to create or replenish that pool and make it bigger.
As everybody will appreciate, you need to fill in at the bottom, you know, to make sure there's a constant flow through. Because also, you know, people get stayed. So you need to keep them fresh by changing them around and putting them into different challenges and different sort of situations so that they feel stimulated. But you do need new people coming in at the bottom. And so it is a challenge to make sure that that flow is a healthy one and that you're left with a balanced team. But having a solid framework so they're not guessing too much. You know, they're going into where as much background information and research and equipment has been put in place as possible, you know, means that they can do their job and also they can learn constructively.
I can imagine that your pool might be right at the sort of the kind of bottom of that pool might be someone who's maybe a junior doctor, maybe somebody who's, you know, got a family practice or something, and think, yeah, gosh, you know, I'd like to try my hand at something a little bit more interesting, a little bit more exciting, but may not have any experience whatsoever, very minimal amount. But then they maybe find you and start to find some of your courses and then start to become proficient in. Is that how is who are attracted to some of the courses that you've
well, I think
that
it's, you put it, on? The, you know, the world is changing, mm-hmm. and it's part of the reason why we've moved from expedition medicine to what we mm-hmm. you know, refer to as extreme medicine. Mm-hmm. In so much as 20 years ago, when we were setting up Across the Divide, we would take doctors on. Mm-hmm. Because at that point, mm-hmm. Paramedics and nurses weren't really, in general, sufficiently trained to a level where we would be happy operating remotely. Mm-hmm. There were individuals, certainly, that were more than competent. Mm-hmm. But actually, the perception in terms of our customers and the marketplace is that actually we needed to be a doctor. Mm-hmm. Now, that's changed considerably
right.
in so much as paramedicine has certainly come on an awfully long mm-hmm. way. Mm-hmm. And, you know, in some respects, a really competent paramedic, you know, in a remote area is more useful at times than a doctor because mm-hmm. the skill set is exactly more relevant. Mm. In a perfect world, what you want is both, and a nurse as well. And, mm-hmm. you know, they all bring different things to the party. So typically, who's attracted to what we do? It is does tend to be sort of junior doctors, mm-hmm. Not newly qualified paramedics and nurses, but, mm-hmm. you know, people, you know, new in their career.
Yes.
What we want to do, which is why we kind of combined all these pre-hospital care, so, you know, air ambulance type skills with military medicine. So mm-hmm. small group medicine in conflict zones with the expedition side and with working with people like Dr. Mike Barrett from NASA, is that previous to what we were doing, these were operating in silos, and yeah, there was some connection, but there wasn't a sharing of knowledge. Mm-hmm. Now, what we're finding is the type of clinicians attracted to each of those different silos are the same people, except they're different individuals. And what we wanted to do was bring them all together in sort of one place where they could share best practice, but also make connections. So the doctors we're bringing forward not only go on to things like survival, but also, as part of their portfolio, might also go and work for MSF, or they might go and do their own expeditions.
Right.
They might go and work in remote Scotland as a GP on a remote island. Mm-hmm. There is a remote there as they are in the pool, essentially, because if the weather closes in and they can't get somebody out, you know, they could be anywhere else. Mm-hmm. You know, they're remote and extreme. Because they have to do everything. They have to deliver babies, have to do the primary care, they have to do trauma.
Yes.
So it's the relevancy of what we're doing is now much more general than when we first started expedition medicine. But also the value that we're delivering and the opportunities we're part of a process of helping to create is good for organisations like MSF and, you know, the wider context of our.
Is there something that you find that's common amongst the mindset of these people, regardless of whether they specialize in polar extreme medicine or jungle extreme medicine or space extreme medicine?
Is I think it's a common theme with the clinicians and people practicing medicine generally is empathy and the desire generally for care, that they care for people.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's probably the underlying thing. And, you know, of course, the nature of what we do also attracts people who are slightly more peripatetic and slightly more adventuresome than others. But the underlying thing that unifies them all is care for people and wanting to help people generally.
That's very cool. That's fascinating.
It is humbling, the people we work with. Some of the things you know, the lives that their own lives that they put on the line at times, and it is really very incredibly humbling.
That's an interesting thing maybe to explore, and I can't remember where I was listening to this, but it was I can't remember the context, but I think it may have been post the earthquake in Haiti or something along those lines. But it was about people doing extreme medicine actually not really perhaps paying as much attention to their own vulnerabilities health-wise. Do you explore that with some of the courses?
Yeah, more and more of what we do, because it's such a big factor in not only medicine but actually in everything that you do is human factors. And I think there's, until recently, there was a taboo about talking about the mental stresses that one undergoes when doing expeditions. When in your conversations with Kathy, I think you touched on this as well, to the point where you actually think it's only you that's you know, in the middle of this enormous trek and it's just hurting. You want to you know, twist your ankle so you can get, you know, remove the pain honorably. You don't, but it's in your mind. You think it's only yours, but actually the realization is everybody goes through this to a different degree. And I realized that when I heard Sir Ranulph Fiennes talking about one of his polo trips where he said he just wanted to break his arm so that he could honorably, you know. Everybody, so we do more and more around human factors, and we work again quite closely with Dr. Mike Barrett at NASA, primarily through our master's program, which we set up with Exeter University, which is the MSc program in extreme medicine, is about, and you know, NASA has a unique set of mission constraints and threats and opportunities, but you know, their methodology around debriefing and learning from mistakes, celebrating success as well, is really quite an interesting sort of process to examine, and a very healthy one to do, because they've learned through trial and practice and also through over many decades. So we do more and more around the how your mind gets affected by what you're doing. So, and in fact, We're running something in the new year with, and we've deliberately not got too many clinicians on the on the faculty, but it's about the stress of being a clinician. One, not only the work stresses, but also the decisions you have to take on a daily basis.
Right.
You know, and not, you're not 100% all the time. Sometimes you're making sort of quite significant decisions when you're actually feeling pretty down.
You're tired.
Yeah, so you have to deal with the aftermath of that.
Yes.
So we're using well, a number of interesting people, but one that sticks out is Eddie the Eagle.
Right.
In terms of saying, you know, life is at times difficult, and this is how I got through it. And using a number of different cases, we're using Aldo Kane, who's a safety advisor for a number of TV sort of personalities, and Foxy from the Channel 4 program, Who Dares Wins.
Right.
You know, who've gone through post-traumatic stress disorder from their time in Afghanistan. So I'm talking about life at times is difficult, and it's not all a bed of roses, but you have to come through the other side. And how do you, how have they come through and sharing the experience, and Kathy's joining us as well, you know, how have they got through that and become even more effective and even, you know, gone on from there. So it's about the mental health and how the mind works with you, but also at times works against you.
Yes. That's some very powerful stuff that is applicable not to just extreme medicine or extreme environments, but you know, a number of contexts.
Yeah, and I think we're specifically tailoring it to the work that we're doing around extreme medicine, but we are actually working on the basis that a lot of the tools we give these give our delegates and give the people participating in this course will be stuff that you use the very next day, and they use it on a daily basis. It's about understanding that everybody's different drivers. It's understanding sort of how teams work. It's understanding that people take information and need information in different ways, and dealing with difficulties, dealing with conflict. You know, often, especially in a hospital environment, a lot of that conflict and anxiety is driven out of fear. You know, and knowing that allows you then to take a different stance if you know that you're dealing with somebody's fear rather than somebody's anger.
Right. And you need to be almost a psychologist to
I think as clinicians
to be able to understand.
You know, I think they're perhaps culturally, and I think this is changing quite a lot now, is that doctors were, to be a great clinician didn't necessarily mean that you had an awful lot of empathy or the ability to communicate with the people you were. And I think that's changing, actually. People, you know, clinicians realize actually being able to talk to your talk to your customers essentially is an essential part, and it's actually an essential part of their recovery as well. But I think medicine's getting, I personally think medicine's getting better and better at that.
Great. Well, that's, that, that is encouraging, because you, you often hear that you go through medical school and it's this sort of, they beast you, and you come out the other end maybe technically pretty good, but
I think medicine itself is changing, and what we, how the way in which medicine is now, it's going to be very different in 10 years' time. Technology is assisting, and that assisting is part of that change. But also I think the upskilling of nurses paramedics means that the boundaries between doctors and nurses and paramedics is certainly in places becoming much less. And I think also the doctors, nurses, realizing actually there's a world of opportunities out there, and they can have portfolio careers. And actually, we would argue that actually doctors and other clinicians going away and having not just the type of experience that we're concerned with extreme medicine, there are lots of others, makes them better clinicians when they return, because they come back with different experiences, they come back with better team working, and perhaps actually come back slightly happier and relaxed, more relaxed.
Yes. I can definitely see that. Do you see a trend in either doctors that are interested in doing this kind of work, or maybe in the types of expeditions and projects that are going on around us, that there's more of them? Or conversely, this is a broad question, so you could take it however you feel, whatever your thoughts are. But conversely, would be the negative side of that, which would be things like conflict, natural disasters. Are these things increasing in frequency? And as a result, the demand for what you're doing in one way or the other is increasing, or has it stayed constant? Or do you see it?
Well, I'm not sure I can answer whether the rate of natural disasters and conflict. Apparently, it seems that it has, but that's the way the media portrays it.
Right.
However, the opportunities or the involvement of medical professionals responding to those is certainly increasing. And I think that's a reflection of the increasing professionalism of things like the UK responses to certain disasters. And clinicians are much more, well, clearly, much more part of that response. Part of the problem, and I'm going to sort of perhaps not quite properly, but in things like with Haiti, there were so many people responding, actually the system gets clogged very quickly and actually does the opposite of help, actually puts more weight onto the system. And so the increasing professionalism, so that aid is targeted, the teams that go out are perhaps getting smaller, more focused now. So that when you go in, you're delivering benefit rather than becoming part of a burden yourself. Now, there's an increasing drive internationally for that to happen, and I think that can only be a good thing. As a result, there are the need and the requirement for medical teams who respond to be suitably trained and experienced and well, not necessarily, but qualified as well, is growing. So the UK now has an organisation called UK Med, which heads up the UK's responses to international disasters, which is, I'm not sure how long it's been running, but let's say for 10 years.
Yes.
Every year that and every disaster they respond to, they get better and better.
Sure.
And a lot of our, a lot of our faculty and the people that have come through across the divide work for them as well. It's that type of medical professional. And as we go back to before, responses like Ebola, and then people do put their own lives are at risk as well by responding to these disasters, and they do it out of empathy and desire to help. So it's humbling to see. We had a conference that we ran at the Royal Society, so we run an annual conference, World Extreme Medicine Conference. We ran it at the Royal Society of Medicine, I think 3 or 4 years ago, and 2 days before the conference, the UK response flight to Ebola, the medical teams going out, was scheduled, so we lost 10 or 15 of our speakers in one fell swoop. But of course, that's the nature of who they are. They'll drop everything and go.
That's what motivates them. It's just this natural empathy.
I think it's I can only speak for them, and also how I would feel. It would be a natural empathy to want to help.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's also stimulating, exciting. Mm-hmm. Lots of problem solving, working in close teams. It's, I would suggest, some of the similar drivers that makes people go on expeditions. Mm. There's a degree of risk, a desire to achieve, but there's also, it's about empathy and wanting to help as well.
Yes, I can see both drivers. The thing about the expedition driver, it's that I find appealing, although I'm not an explorer, is just the unknown, the uncertainty. The first, as you said, I'm the first person that set foot in this part of the world. The problem solving, I would have thought, the Ebola and how it might morph and the world may not have seen something like this before, and so to be there and trying to understand it and studying, that is very stimulating.
It is very stimulating. Mm. I think that's probably a large part of what attracts people to extreme medicine as well, is that it's stimulating. And the medical subdiscipline, and we were written up in The Lancet a couple of years ago, the medical subdiscipline is so new. But in 10 years, 20 years' time, when it's developed, it's still going to have those unknowns. It's still going to be the same.
There will always be the edges,
right?
There's
always going to be the edges. And, responding to Ebola in 5 years' time is still going to be as there's a significant lesson. It's still going to be stimulating. There's still going to be lots of problem solving. That's not going
to
stop.
What's strange to me is you have Dr. Michael Barrett speaking at your World Extreme Medicine Conference, and we are talking about colonizing Mars in several decades, or who knows when. There will always be these people. It's the human condition, I think, to try and push the extremes, whether that's the deepest oceans or whatever. And so you will always have a demand for medical professionals that will work alongside that.
And Dr. Michael spoke last year at the conference and addressed the audience, and the audience is about 400 people or so, and said, within the next sort of 5 to 10 years, a number of you in the audience will be treating returning space travelers because more people are going to be starting to go as it gets commercialized going into space. So boundaries are going to be constantly pushed. And physical frailty is the inability of ourselves to acclimatize to altitude or to depths and cold, are still going to remain. So as we push ourselves, we're still going to be suffering as well.
Yeah, I think it's just the human condition. I think it's the human condition to explore and to suffer and to venture into the unknown and, all of that stuff. That's how
it would,
that's for better or for worse, that's what's great about our species, but also that's what's terrible about our species.
I think that's important for better or for worse.
Yes. This is really fascinating stuff. If you were to, what's the biggest constraint, perhaps at this point in time, in terms of doing what it is that you do? What's the one of the biggest challenges?
Well, I think it's a twofold question. The biggest challenges is that there really is nobody's done what we're doing.
Right.
So it's a little bit of going into the unknown in terms of creating and forming this sort of medical subdiscipline, but it also gives us an immense opportunity because one of the things I've always, in fact, we're doing something with the Natural History Museum, is there's these clinical avenues that we sort of built a home for, but there's also, there's so much more out there in the world that can benefit medicine per se and the medicine in the extremes. So, talking to animal physiologists about how animals adapt to extreme conditions and what can we learn. And a very simple example of that is Dr. Lucy Hawkes, who we work with at the conference, uses the example bar-headed geese. Bar-headed geese live on the plains of India, migrate through the Himalayas to the Tibetan Plateau, and don't need to acclimatise. Now, the relevancy of that is, when human bodies are in low oxygen would be when we're in intensive care, when we're in a trauma situation. Now, if we can understand how bar-headed geese overcome the challenges of those huge changes in altitude without the need to acclimatise, and how those biological systems work, there's some relevancy there then for enabling us to be treated more effectively in trauma wards or in intensive care wards. So we're working with the Natural History Museum and a good friend of mine called Professor Craig Franklin, who was the scientific advisor for Steve Irwin. And he's a crocodilian expert. Right. So, but you know, he's a professor in zoology, so his knowledge is far, far broader.
Yes.
But it's looking at these species who operate in extremes, and the bar-headed geese are one, deep diving mammals are others, and there are innumerable other examples. Bringing them into the Natural History Museum, and then bringing clinicians to talk about how humans adapt, and building a network of knowledge where actually it's all about people, connecting these people so they actually have engaging conversations and share knowledge. And part of, I think, part of the legacy work, what I consider stands around the grand title, but you know, I'm hoping that there'll be a bright young number of bright young clinicians or scientists, what have you, sitting in the audience for whom in 5 years' time, when they embark on a research project, will suddenly have a eureka moment and say, now what did I hear and who was that person, and then be able to connect dots so that actually medical science improves, but you know, possibly also sort of veterinary science and animal science. But there's a sharing of knowledge and a neural network that's created by doing so. So it's also bringing the opportunity is to bring animal physiologists into extreme medicine and connect them all up.
That's in any number of fields. That's where a huge amount of value gets created when you take a little bit from one field,
the margins, and bringing the margins
exactly
together.
Exactly. And that's where innovation happens, and that's where, you know, the great discoveries happen, and or you know, just...
Well, great discoveries would be great, but even just a small one would be nice.
Small ones, yes, absolutely.
And generating new research projects, and...
And what's great, I think we, certainly in the academic context sometimes, and I feel this professionally, is we get specialized, right? We're in the little silos, and... And that creates insularity and inertia, and you know, we need to start to break out of those things.
Going right back to the beginning, I think one of the benefits of being a geographer is you're a master of no trades but a jack of all, and actually being, and also I think helpfully in my particular instance, being a non-clinician allows me a little bit to sit back and not be blinded by obstacles and actually just build bridges, because I don't know enough not to do
it, and
actually there's a benefit there.
I'd like to talk just a little bit about your entrepreneurial journey, because you did. You are quite the entrepreneur, and I wanted to talk about your own views and philosophies on risk and uncertainty, and doing what you do. And do these things just sort of happen naturally? You just kind of you're in a space, and then there's the adjacent space of you're working with across the divide, and then you see this, we do this on medicine, and well, wouldn't it be great if we start to bring people together? And I'm not sure that
certainly my entrepreneurial experience has been both hugely positive, but also really quite stressful at times as well, as any entrepreneur's journey is. I'm not sure I've really stood back from it sufficiently to be able to identify what the elements of that are, except to be able to identify the bits in me, a desire to create. And the desire to create means that often, you know, those flights of fancy, and I think that's perhaps the difference between a dreamer and an entrepreneur, and those flights of fancy, you start breaking them down into the little bits that make components, which make the next steps, and those next steps generate their own energy. And typically what's the way that I personally worked is when you're making those steps and you're getting, you know, we actually did this yesterday. We connected with an organization to build a sort of actually a very new sort of medical sort of training program, and it was purely by sitting down and dreaming and thinking, well, how could we do that? And I think when you get, you know, the dots connecting, and there's a creative energy, that's how I've personally followed my line, and it's just dreaming and being. And I've got children now, so I want to stay in you know, I travel a lot with them, but I want to be a father. So going away and doing expeditions, to my mind, doesn't really give me the time and that I want to spend with my children. But as a consequence, so that's going right back to the beginning and waking up every day with a different view outside my tent, you know, translates into the way that I erratically at times run my businesses, in so much as every day is different because we're generating new ideas, we're generating new projects on a relatively constant basis, and it's the joy I personally get at creation or creating the new which drives me forward, and it does mean that my tent door has a different view each day, and it might be one driven by creativity of doing the extreme medicine, or actually might be going on trips.
How do you approach, look at, manage the risks that you're businesses face, and
what do you do about those things? With some degree of erratic success, and at times less so. So I think as one gains more and more experience, that becomes more instinctive and intuitive. And I guess, you know, I'm less of a structural leader, creator, and I'm more of an intuitive creator. So it's, I mean, running relatively small businesses puts you very close to the coalface. So, you know, you're always quite aware of the risk you're taking because actually it impacts on you very, very quickly. So how do I ameliorate risk? I think it's by, you know, I know my market really well. So that certainly helps. I know, you know, I spend a reasonable, and we as a team spend a real amount of time looking at competition and what other people are doing. You know, one of the advantages of being one of the leaders of what we're doing is that nobody's done what we've done before, so you don't know whether it's going to be successful or not. So now it's about, I think we probably jump a little bit less quickly than we did, but when we jump, we do so with a bit more experience and knowledge behind us. You know, when we know things that haven't worked for us, and we know things that do work for us. So there is a pool of knowledge that's traveling with us now that we didn't have, obviously, 10, 20 years ago. But what we do is all about people. So the risk is that we meet somebody and we don't connect with them. But generally, you know, the people we're connecting with are empathetic and adventuresome. Yes. You know, it's a natural progress.
Yes. That's great. What a wonderful business to be in, and world to, you know, you've really forged the world that you want for yourself out of the various experiences that you've had, and that's, you know, I think it's a great lesson.
Well, I think you know, I feel that we're delivering social benefit. You know, we're enabling doctors to be better doctors in different places, and clinicians to find new opportunities and go out and do medicine in remote areas better.
You seem like an optimist about the state of the world, even though, you know, some of what you're dealing with on the, you know, sort of maybe or some of the people that you're working with on the natural disaster side, or, you know, conflict zones, or, you know, when you read the headlines, as we were talking about, it can, you know, can certainly depress us. But you're on the coalface of that, and I can sense a positivity around where the world is going with you. But maybe I've got that wrong.
Well, I think, do you know what? I mean, there is. I'm excited about what we're doing, and I think virtually everybody that we work with that works in the field on these things is also they tend to be optimists, because actually you have to be an optimist to think that you're going to come home.
Yes.
And come home in one piece.
Yes.
So if you were a more negative personality, you probably wouldn't go in the first place, because you'd probably think the risk was too strong.
Sure.
So one of the great joys of what I do is being surrounded by massively clever, bright, adventuresome optimists. And it does make for a happier world for me.
Where do you see the world of extreme medicine in 15 years, 10, 15 years?
I think our remit is going to be much wider. I think, you know, every year we see more people becoming involved because we're illustrating the opportunities and also providing a home and a hub and a community where Clearly, we talk about our courses and the conference, but also we talk about lots of other stuff, other opportunities, other people's courses. You know, we see our part of our responsibility is serving our community in however way, in terms of presenting best practice. You know, working with partners like Médecins Sans Frontières to highlight their opportunities. But it's also a little bit of stripping away some of the romanticism of what we do, and that, and the presenting the reality, because the last thing you want is for somebody to take a challenge like this on, to go into the field and realise it absolutely not their cup of tea at all. It doesn't do anybody any good, including the individual. So we want to sort of strip away some of the romanticism and say, do you know, some of the stuff is really quite hard. You know, and you do need to, you know, depending on what you're doing, you do need to be reasonably physically fit. You also need to understand that you're going to be isolated. You might be under, you know, there's all the massive positives, but there's also negatives. So it's about educating people. So I think we're going to see more people get becoming involved in that and delivering, well, going on exhibition for their own selfish needs, selfish wants, but also delivering aid, medicine, being involved overseas. We will inevitably see, I think, more structure grow into that. And we've got a, you know, a program with Exeter University, which is going to be part of that from our side. And I think we'll see greater opportunity. I think the world is becoming smaller, and technology is allowing it, allowing medical.
That's a great point. I have a friend who's just decided to quit her job with her partner. She's sold their house, and they're going to go sailing around the world for 2 years. And I think that's great. But now there's all kinds of resources. If you want to do something like that, there are actually people who've done that before. There's probably some there's probably a blog out there. I don't know, but there are ways to find out what goes in.
It's an increasingly different one, as everybody's aware. But also, you know, the power of mobile devices in terms of being able to diagnose means that, you know, and again, I'm going to simplify this statement quite a lot, but you no longer need to be a doctor with several years of training or experience to do certain medical evaluations or monitoring in the field. You can be, you could have got, you know, with the power of a mobile phone and stuff, you know, the ability to monitor and gather medical data can now be done by much less experienced qualified. So our ability to deliver medical medical care in remote areas is becoming more and more expansive, and I think that's only going to change as technology becomes more and more powerful, and the ability to transmit data and diagnose and do callback and remote diagnosis.
You could probably do a whole another podcast guest. I'm not sure when this will go out in relation to that one, because I want to get this one out around or just before the Extreme Medicine Conference, but he sailed also around the world with and he had some medical backup, or but what he could do is he could diagnose something, send it in, and you get a doctor to help work with the problem.
I think medicine's going to change immensely over the next sort of decades and stuff, and I think we're going to start to see, you know, in artificial intelligence being used more and more to provide medical care as well, or medical diagnosis and treatment. It's fascinating where it's going to go, and it's just, and I think, to a degree, it's impossible for us to imagine all that can be achieved, because some of the stuff that's going to achieve doesn't exist right now, but will do.
Exciting times. Before we wrap up, I wanted to also just give you the opportunity to tell a little bit more about the World Extreme Medicine Conference, and I'm hoping that this will go out around that time, so if people are interested, they can check that out. But
so the it's the world's largest gathering of extreme medics, and again, it's a crossover between sort of pre-hospital care, disaster humanitarian medicine, and sort of extreme expedition. And we've got all sorts of maverick medics coming, from NASA astronauts to small group military medics to Everest Summiteers to NASA NEMU, you know, doing medicine underneath the surface.
So Mark Beaumont, the guy, the cyclist around the world in less than 80 days.
You know, his physical achievement, he's a trained athlete, but still remarkable. You know, he, to be cycling I'm not sure exactly what his averages were, but it was in that 300 kilometer, 400 kilometer,
300, 400 days,
yep. Day after day. You know, within the first 9 days, he'd fallen off his bike and knocked his tooth out. We did reach back for him then, and did got an amazing dentist of ours, Borja Landana, who worked for the British Antarctic Survey as one of their dentists, to give him a remote, tell his Laura Penhall, who was his sports physio on the 80 days, who also is part of our faculty, talk her through how she needed to fill that cavity and repair the tooth. And he cycled with that and had another, a number of other incidents along the way. Quite a remarkable achievement. Mm. So that's going to be he's going to be interesting. Mm-hmm. We've also got Dr. Nick Clark and Penn Haddo, who've just returned from sailing from the northernmost point.
I'm hoping to have Penn Haddo on this podcast. Are you? But hoping to make that happen.
I hear that. Well, one, he's got a fascinating story to tell, but I also hear he's great at public speaking and business.
Right.
So he's going to be an interesting character.
Yes. That sounds fabulous. Yeah. So before we wrap up, if people want to know more about you, the World Extreme Medicine Conference, the work that you do, what are some of the places on social media where people could go?
We've got a very active Facebook group, which is Extreme Medicine, World Extreme Medicine on Facebook. I think it's Extreme Medicine. Mm-hmm. We've got two websites. Mm-hmm. One is one of the courses, which is extreme-medicine.com.
Right.
And then we've got the conference website. Essentially, if anybody types in extreme medicine into Google, you'll get the conference and you get the courses.
Yes, I was looking at some of the courses, and some of them are fascinating. And so I was wondering, but I don't have any background in this. But some of them say, the level of this is easy or this is hard or whatever. So you could probably find some courses that you can
expanding the number of courses. Mm-hmm. We've got. The course on the mini conference we're doing with people like Eddie the Eagle in January, which we're calling Wemski, which is in the Italian Alps. Mm. So using the mountain skiing and also these incredible individuals to actually, I think, create a really interesting week around human factors and dealing with stress.
Yes.
But if anybody, I'm more than welcome to connect with people on LinkedIn and via Facebook personally, and type in Mark Hannaford, Extreme Medicine, I will undoubtedly come up.
Great. Mark, this was fabulous. I enjoyed every minute of it. Was there anything that we didn't cover off that you wanted to mention?
World of stuff. We could be here for hours.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
But no, it's fascinating talking to you as well, Buster.
No, thank you.
Thank you for inviting me.
Great stuff, and wish you all the best. And I'd love to have you back as well. So,
well, it'd be great to get you up to the conference and get you to report from the conference.
Wonderful. Yeah, hopefully we can make that happen.
Yeah.
Perfect. Wonderful. Thanks, Mark.
Thank you, Ben.
I hope you guys enjoyed that. If you are in the UK, check out the World Extreme Medicine Conference, which starts on the 25th of November in Edinburgh, Scotland. And if you can't make that, but you are interested in Mark's work, check out the training courses that his organization offers. The links are all in the show notes. Our next episode will be out in 2 weeks, but we may come back with an in-between episode next week. And once again, I'd like to invite you to send me any feedback, suggestions, or comments to allthingsrisk@gmail.com. I would love to hear from you. You can also do that via allthingsrisk.co.uk. And if you like the show, I'd really appreciate if you could share it or leave a rating or review on iTunes or simply subscribe if you haven't yet done so. We'll be back soon in the interim. And as always, don't forget, risk is life.